Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 644. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm back with another great conversation and great guests lined up. I'm here with my good friend, Danny Olinger, who is the General Secretary for the OPC's Committee on Christian Education. Welcome back, Danny. It's good to see you today.
Hey, thanks, Camden.
Yeah, glad you could make it. I'm excited to be speaking with you. We've got a great conversation lined up, and as people watching the video can see, Danny's got his notes galore in his way. So you're not doing the 3x5 index cards, or unless maybe there are a few in there, but we've got some multicolored notes. Yes, there we go. Just you've gone to colored. I like it. And we're going to be talking about some fun stuff. We've been having some conversations on the phone and over email, and decided to try to get one down for the podcast. We're going to be going a little bit in a different direction than we typically do, but still very organic and germane to the concerns here of Christ the Center. As we speak today about Catholic theology, specifically leading up to and then during and post-Vatican II, but doing so through the lens of the novels of British author Graham Greene. Graham Greene was regarded by many as one of the leading English novelists of the 20th century, a very popular author. He combined a literary acclaim with widespread popularity, something that's actually quite difficult to do. And he's widely known and gained a reputation early in his lifetime, even as a major writer of novels, of what people have called Catholic novels. Even though apparently Green did not like the phrase Catholic novels, he preferred to be thought of as a Catholic who wrote novels rather than a writer who wrote Catholic novels. But he also wrote political and espionage thrillers. For a time, he worked for MI6. And twice, now get this, now all of that, you could say, wow, this guy's a popular writer, no big deal. Twice he was shortlisted for the Nobel Prize for Literature. So this is no joke. And why we're talking about him today is this, because in his works, Green explored the ambivalent moral and political issues of the modern world, but often through a Catholic perspective. So he's wrestling with themes inherent in Catholic theology and how they applied to the modern world. And there's a lot of opportunity for us to dive into the life and the works of Graham Greene to a degree and talk about these themes. But just to back up a little bit, of course, some people will know Danny is the author of Gerhardus Voss, a Reformed Biblical Theologian, Confessional Presbyterians. If you're watching the video, I've got a copy of that down there, a book that Reformed Forum published a while ago and only have a couple copies left. So we haven't yet printed our second print run, but I'm going to have to do that soon. But copies are still available if you head on over to reformedforum.org/store. The book's there, and I'll get that mailed out to you as soon as I can, Lord willing. And we've had lots of great conversations through the years, and if you click on Danny's name in the episode description, it'll bring up all of our previous conversations, some of which include conversations on Vatican II theology. But Danny, I'd love for you just to remind people who may not have listened to those previous episodes or who may have forgotten just your experience at Duquesne University out near Pittsburgh and some of your interactions with contemporary Catholicism through the years.
Yeah, I had the opportunity in the 1990s to attend Duquesne for a master's in theology. And so I was right in the heart of Vatican II, Roman Catholicism, and just really enjoyed it. Got to really study the documents and the modern theologians, and hopefully, with the goal of trying to help those in the Reformed faith as we engage with Catholics. And it's so broad. Catholicism is so complex that it's hard for people to make their way through. And so this was, I thought, was invaluable to be able to experience that and then try to help others moving forward.
Yeah, it is immense. Even 10 years ago, I believe the count was 1.2 billion Roman Catholics in the world. And when you think about any group that large, there's going to be huge variety and variation. I often like to make this comparison, and the comparison is apt, but when we're thinking about evangelicalism, just ask a Reformed person or, what's an evangelical? And describe to me the range of views within evangelicalism. Well, that's a tiny sliver just in terms of numbers of what you might find in Catholicism. And so to ask what Catholicism teaches is actually quite a difficult thing. And you would imagine that given the structure of the church and the magisterium and the way the church views its own authority and its documents and pronouncements, you would imagine that it would be easier to just point to a document and say, that's what Catholicism teaches. But often, especially with Vatican II documents, they're written in such a way where they can be taken in all sorts of different directions. And that's kind of the point, that they're, it's meant to be this kind of thing that kind of binds people together visibly. But at the same time, you can have a vast array and breadth of views where really you can find people who are hardcore conservative, kind of Tridentine Catholics. The Protestants are anathema. The Pope is, you know, infallible come 1870s, all that stuff. And then you also find people that don't believe Jesus Christ rose from the dead physically, but it was a spiritual resurrection, and they're practically, not just practically, but just universalists. God's grace is available in the world. The world itself is a sacrament. And if you try to be a good person and transcend yourself and you give yourself up to the mystery on the horizon of your existence, it doesn't matter whether you are an explicit professing Christian, or if you're a Muslim or a Jew or a Hindu or just a flat out professing atheist, God will meet you with his grace wherever you are in that moment of giving yourself over. You can be, yes, an anonymous Christian. So we find all of that is with under the heading of post-Vatican II Catholicism. You know, and how did you find your experience at Duquesne kind of dealing with flesh and blood folks that were all about that?
Wow, it was an eye-opener in regard to I thought, for instance, the ancient church, the ecumenical councils, I'd have safe common ground there. And I found out very quickly that it was a radical reinterpretation of so much of what the church had done. But because it was the church, the magisterium that ultimately determined the truth, didn't really matter.
Exactly.
So it was just an eye opener. It was modern Catholicism has a place for everyone, and that's what the earthly genius of Vatican II was. By adding experience to the sources of authority, so you have scripture, tradition, reason, experience. You have everything covered, and it's just ingenious in that respect.
I found that, you know, hard to grasp when I first encountered Vatican II theology, that typically what the Reformed people, Protestants, we typically look at Catholicism and if we find some contradictions within some of the official teachings in the past, then people are apt to say, well, look, there's a contradiction. Therefore, the church cannot be demonstrating its infallibility and authority. Therefore, you know, it proves that it's wrong and incorrect. But post-Vatican II, the church typically doesn't care about things like that. And the doctrine can change over time, and not just in the sense of John Henry Newman's kind of development of doctrine, but in a real kind of modernist philosophical sense. God can reveal himself in new ways that are authoritative and infallible. Nevertheless, might, on the surface, or even genuinely, contradict prior revelation. So a guy like Karl Rahner could say we need Chalcedon was good and helpful, but it was written in the 400s, and we need a new Christology for an evolutionary view of the world. The worldviews have changed. Modern life has changed so much. We need new ecumenical documents that address matters in today's parlance or today's context or vernacular, whatever we want to say. And those documents of today might, in fact, contradict something that had been revealed before, because what was revealed before was for those people in those times and those contexts. So it can be taken in a very radical, historicized direction, But what that does is it allows for the church to go in any direction that it would like to go. You could have married priests. You could have female priests. You could theoretically, under such a philosophical umbrella, permit homosexual marriage, you name it. I mean, if God is still speaking today, and by that we mean could say anything and everything, you know, independent of what he's said before and independent of what he has revealed before, then really everything is available and permissible to the theologian and to the church to declare it. So anyway, these are the cultural and theological shifts that the Catholic Church was wrestling with in the 50s and then leading up to Vatican II, which is 1962 to 1965. Graham Greene, my memory serves me, was born in 1904 and died in 1991. And so he came of age in a time which, you know, basically came of age right when modernism was just ravaging the church, and not just the Presbyterian American church, but the whole world. And the Catholic anti-modernist oath was issued in 1910 when Greene would have been six. But Greene's writings and his themes are often addressing real-life practical issues about doubt, guilt, nature of faith, how other people view other people, what your relationship to the church is, what it means to be a Catholic, so to speak. How were you introduced to some of these themes, Danny? How were you introduced to Greene in general? Who suggested that you take a look at these sorts of things for your own edification?
Yes, when I was at Duquesne, I was at Grace Church in Swickley with Charlie Dennison, OPC pastor and historian Charlie Dennison, and he recommended that I start reading Greene, particularly the Catholic novels. And so I would read these novels the same time I was attending the school, and it was just amazing. I think Greene's his five Catholic novels are unparalleled. They're, to me, as good as anything written in the 20th century, and particularly when you combine his great ability as a literary figure, his ability with storytelling, his ability with plot, narrative, his ability with prose. He's considered, I think, perhaps the greatest prose writer in of the English novelists of the 20th century. And then his insights into Catholicism during that time, it's just spellbinding. I found myself with what happened and a month ago is I started reading Rusty Reno's diaries on him trying to find a place to worship in New York City during this quarantine, to observe the Mass. And immediately I thought of Greene's The Power and the Glory. And I thought, oh, I need to read The Power and the Glory again. And I read it, and it's just like, this is even better than I remembered. It was spectacular. And then went on and read The Heart of the Matter, and also thought it was just, you know, he is so prophetic in certain things that were coming up with Catholicism, and yet his theology, he's an apostate, a heretic almost in certain respects. So you could see why he also just really rubbed Orthodox Catholics the wrong way when he was in the midst of writing these novels.
Yeah. Now, I started, picked up a few days ago, A Burnt Out Case, as per your recommendation that we take a look at Greene, and really was loving it. And I'm currently reading The Power and the Glory. I haven't finished it yet. I'm hoping that, we can read that and perhaps revisit that in a future episode. So if listeners are interested, you can pick up Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory, start reading it, and hopefully in a future episode of Christ the Center, we can dive down into more specific detail with the themes in that novel and talk about the theological issues therein. But in A Burnt Out Case, you have I hope I'm not spoiling anything because it was revealed pretty early on, but a world-renowned architect who's burnt out and finds no more joy in what he does, and he kind of enters into the heart of darkness, Conrad's heart of darkness, going up river in the Congo. eventually unto a leper colony, which is run by, you know, a seminary. And he's Catholics there. And there's a doctor kind of in charge of the leper colony who's an atheist. But the main character, this burnt-out architect, you know, grew up a Catholic and was kind of labeled a Catholic, but doesn't believe. He's an atheist too. And what you find in that whole book is this notion that there's this contrast often between the atheists and the overtly religious. And they're often more categorized kind of as Pharisaical, the people that know, and the priests and the other, you know, lay people who are very overtly religious are actually not the good people. And they don't live and they don't live out a true and genuine faith, you know, with works of love, so to speak. The atheists are the ones that actually help people and love people. But then what's interesting is that the main burnt out character keeps telling everyone he doesn't believe, like he's not a Catholic. He doesn't think these things, but they lift him up as a saint because he does certain things that they appreciate. And then they all kind of rally around him and look to him for advice and everything. And there's a very surprise kind of turn of events and everything. So it's worth reading to read the rest of A Burnt Out Case. But the many themes there is a lot of critics have kind of identified the main character as a reflection of Green himself, who did not believe these things or, you know, or struggled with faith, you know, is more of an outward Catholic, if anything, you know, Catholic in name only, but would be open and honest about what he believed was right and real and true and whatnot. But no matter how hard he tried, people kept looking to him for religious answers and holding him up as some Catholic par excellence.
Yeah, that's a great, great summary. That was that book was one of Charlie Dennison's favorite. And I believe it was because some of the tensions that you're describing there, in that Green, I think, was getting to the fact that you could go through the motions of a Catholicism, a Trent of a Vatican I Catholicism, and be far removed from God himself. And so what are you believing in? And that's what's really getting at is, are you believing in this ideal or you're believing in God himself? And so it's very existential, very much getting to the heart of the faith, which as you said, it was the last of his Catholic novels. And it did really discourage his good friend, Evelyn Waugh, who had become famous also as a Catholic writer in England for Brideshead Revisited, really saw in this book Green leaving the faith and becoming a total lapsed Catholic. And so he was very disheartened by it. Waugh was very Orthodox, Roman Catholic. But I think it's brilliant on Green's part, literally, to start with Brighton Rock, which is a morality tale about a Catholic and a secular vision, and to move all the way through 20 years later and come to A Burnout Case, and he leaves it. He's leaving the faith, and it's fascinating to me because I kept on, as I first was reading these books and going to Duquesne, I kept on thinking, there's something here that Green's saying about the tension one feels in being a Catholic in this system and what it means to live out this faith. And he's really, I thought he was exposing something there. And I think he was also onto something in that. So by that time, when he writes the book, it's exactly when John the 23rd is becoming Pope. So the book it fits that timetable exactly. And so there's a lot of frustration about modern Catholics like Green on the edge of what was going on. And so John the 23rd was like their savior, that he was going to call this council and open up the church. Mm-hmm. But by this point, I think Green had it. And, he writes this book, and it's underrated. I think it's one of his best. And it's not generally considered one of his Catholic novels, but I definitely think it is. And I think Roger Sherrick, who I think is the best interpreter of Green, places it dead set in the Catholic novels also.
Yeah, some of the other books we mentioned, like The Power and the Glory, those are often listed within that Catholic novel label, which is not a label that, Green gave to his books, but I can't, you know, The Burnt Out Case, of course, it's right there in the middle of it. You have this guy in a seminary, you know, dealing with lepers, and you have all those biblical themes of leprosy and all of that is still evident and at work within the book. But wrestling with these deep themes of what is it to be a Catholic? What is it to be a saint? What is it that other people see and venerate about people? And why do they do that? It's just deep. It's what literature ought to be. I mean, in this true sense of the art form, it's not just reading for entertainment. That's what genre fiction's for. But if a book is true literature, this is my opinion. I mean, other people have different ideas. You know, some people view genres as just types of writing and then literature is another genre. I don't subscribe to that theory. I think there are genres of writing, but if something is truly literature, it transcends the genre and addresses issues of human existence in an artistic way. So you can find a lot of the books of Cormac McCarthy, for example, ostensibly as Westerns, they're, you know, or apocalyptic, the road. But it's literature because it's not meant for the purpose of escapism within a certain setting or form. You're not reading the road just to be entertained by zombies, you know, as you would if you're reading other apocalyptic literature. You're reading the road to deal with, you know, the human plight. And so what we find with a lot of these other works with Green, they can't just be categorized. Now, I haven't read his thrillers and whatnot, but with the Catholic novels, no matter what setting we find themselves in, they're certainly not limited by genre. They're true literature, and they're truly dealing with these deep issues. And they reward the patient and thoughtful reader in the way that good books ought to do.
Oh, I totally agree. There's a fascinating introduction, actually a 50th anniversary piece that John Updike wrote on Green's The Power and the Glory. And you could tell how much Updike appreciated Green, but Updike points out that Green, in these novels, Green is identifying his characters, the central characters, are born of another world, and they're trying to find their place in this world. And what happens is that Green has such expertise in describing London or describing West Africa or describing Mexico that you feel you're there. But then he puts these characters in opposition to them, except for one place, and that's The Power of the Glory, where the whiskey priest becomes identical with the land. But it's brilliant because you begin to realize he's moving on like four different levels at once. And I think that's why he becomes a fascination to some of the great literary figures of the 20th century. Orwell was fascinated with Green's Catholic novels. Wall was fascinated with Green's Catholic novels. Flannery O'Connor was fascinated with them. John Updike. I mean, these are the heavyweights, and they're all coming back to Green and saying, hey, there's something deep going on in these novels.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, you know, tell us a bit about how Green interacted with the church itself. You know, it's some elements of his biography. How was he received? We've already kind of described that he kind of maddened some of the officials, but in what way? And, you know, how did the struggle that is described within his novels kind of reflect what was going on in the church as a whole?
Yeah, wow. This is where to start. He converts to Catholicism to marry a Catholic, but his heart has truly changed, it appears. Now, this becomes autobiographical in some of these Catholic books, The Heart of the Matter. Is along these lines, and The End of the Affair is along these lines. But what happens, I think, is that there's some world events really really draw him in. So first he goes to Mexico. He's writing these travel books, and he gets in southern Mexico, and he learns about the persecution of the priests there. In the 1920s, over 4,000 priests were killed in Mexico, and the church was, there was an atheist dictator on the throne. And this really impacts him in regard to what's going to have a lasting value. What is indestructible? Will this dictator be the one who lasts, or will the church be the one that lasts? And so that really, in that sense, he is inspiring. But here's what's maddening to the Orthodox Catholics. So in one sense, he creates this tension between the city of God and the city of man, and it's Augustinian. But on the other hand, he believes in regard to the fiction that what is of interest to him is the mixed human heart. So he's always thinking about the dark side or the edges between loyalty and disloyalty, between fidelity and infidelity. And he's also carrying with him an incredibly accurate notion of the church, the Roman Catholic Church, that is, mm-hmm. in that the morality of the office does not impact the sacrament. And so he makes his Catholics the worst moral people you would ever find.
Right.
So his very first book, that really the Catholic novel, Brighton Rock, which is a famous book, famous movie about it, he makes the protagonist a 17-year-old murderer, Pinky, gangster, who is utterly obsessed about Catholicism, or at least he's a catechized youth who believes in repentance and hell.
Right.
And so this just infuriates the Catholics. It's like, you know, he's committing all these mortal sins, and you're giving him a pass, and you're saving him at the end of the book. And so he takes it one step further in The Power and the Glory, and he makes this this moral, you know, figure who's very contra what Catholicism believes about sin, the whiskey priest. So the whiskey priest is fathers an illegitimate child. The whiskey priest basically does everything that would violate good Catholicism. But he has this belief that there's no salvation outside of the church, and he's willing to die for it, even though he's a coward, as he goes about trying to do that. And so what happens is, if this is the point where the Holy Office condemns the Power and the Glory. So back then, in the 1940s, you had the Holy See, the Holy Office. There would be a prohibited list, and they put this book on the prohibited list, because he basically in the book just tramples upon Catholic morality. And he's basically saying, this mortal sin stuff, I don't believe one bit in it, but I do believe that salvation is only found in the church. And so that becomes a great tension with Green's Catholic novels, with the magisterium. By the time he gets to the heart of the matter, it becomes even worse, because Green doubles down, and he has the main character be a practicing Catholic who in the end commits suicide. And so again, this is where George Orwell really took Green to task. And he said, look, if you're saying all these things about the church, then why are you not having any of your characters actually be affected by grace and actually repenting and living like they actually believe there's a heaven and a hell, which is an incredible exchange. Orwell published that in the New Yorker in 1948. And so it's just, so what the Catholic Church is struggling with is, he's the most famous Catholic author in the world, much less England.
He becomes the spokesperson by default.
And here he is trampling upon these matters, but at the same time, what he is doing, and this is what I found so fascinating 25 years ago at Duquesne University, almost every one of his themes, in a certain respect, anticipates the change from Vatican I to Vatican II. He is ingenious in getting at this is how Catholicism needs to change, because it's not getting to the true faith as it should, but yet there's no other hope for the world except in this faith.
Yeah, there's a lot going on there. And Vatican II came about, John the 23rd called for it, 1962. John the 23rd was almost universally well-liked. He was a gregarious fellow, and it might not have been possible for another pope to have called the council, certainly not in the way that he did. But he didn't live very long, and he died during the council, and Paul VI took over. And there's questions as to how the council might have turned out differently had John the 23rd seen it all the way through. But even given Paul VI, who was much more conservative, came into power to reign as the Pope, I think, you know, widely recognized Vatican II changed things. Now, there's a great debate as to how and according to what principles. There's a view that there's a great liberalizing of the church. There's another view, which is championed also by Cardinal Ratzinger, who is the Pope Emeritus at the moment, that viewed the church not as changing radically or liberalizing, but changing significantly according to an older tradition. So there's these twin parallels. And I don't think we always have to see them as diametric opposites, polar opposites. But there's aggiornamento, which is this Italian word for updating, where they wanted to open the windows of the Catholic Church and let the fresh airs come in to refresh the doctrine and life. And then this notion of ressourcement, which is a return to an older, more pristine tradition. So I don't know. I wrestle and I take more of the liberalizing side of things, even though the Pope Emeritus doesn't, but I think the current Pope probably does. So we have a battle between Ratzinger and Bergoglio or Francis. You can watch Netflix, The Two Popes, if you want kind of a semi-fictionalized account of those two. But what we do find is that either road you take, whether you are viewing or categorizing the changes of Vatican II as a radical change or a significant change according to an older, purer tradition, the fact of the matter is there's a big change one way or the other, and it's different. And the church now is addressing and approaching world religions, for example, and social issues in a completely new stance and a new standpoint. And I don't know. I mean, I'm a neophyte to Green, but when I read his books, it seems as if, you know, the struggle he's experiencing is really, he's the subject, the needed subject of the aggiornamento. I mean, he's wrestling with and living the stresses that brought about the council to begin with, so to speak. And the fact that the council was called by John the 23rd, and then they were seeking to update the church to meet the needs of the modern person in one way, shape, or form. They sought to, I think, add some hope or some salve to some of these modern problems. And so who knows how things would have turned out if Green was born, I don't know, 20 years later. It's interesting just to compare the two in the historical timeline.
I want to give you a list. I'll reveal the list, but in reading Green's Catholic novels, I think all of this can hold up, and then I'll reveal the list, but he is often putting over against one another in tension or in contrast, definition versus mystery, ruling, serving, fault-finding, appreciation, behavior modification versus inner appropriation, coercion versus conscience, commands versus invitations, withdrawal versus integrated, triumphalism versus humiliation. That list, I think overwhelmingly, you can write article after article on what he did in these books on that list. But that's not a list about his books. That is a list of mm-hmm. what Richard John Neuhaus said that John O'Malley was trying to achieve in his book, in his historical writings upon Vatican II, and what happened in the church in moving from pre-Vatican II to Vatican II and post-Vatican II. This was the goal of the council. Now, Neuhaus was disputing whether O'Malley was accurate. He loved reading O'Malley, thought he was a lot of fun. He actually thought, you know, O'Malley leaned left, and Neuhaus would be more in line with Matthew Lamb and Levering. But I found it fascinating to think about these terms in regard to Green, because this is exactly what he's getting at. He's saying there's a definition, and so the heart of the matter is where it's really the clearest. The heart of the matter is so incredible, because at the end of the book, when Scobie goes to write, he's going to commit this suicide, there are these handcuffs above his desk as he writes. And he is locked in, handcuffed by Catholicism, which will not allow him to give his heart to others. And he is going to do this act, which is an unpardonable sin in Catholicism. And Green is more or less saying, this is what the strict definition, this is what morality by seminary and rule of thumb has brought Catholics to in certain respects. And so Green does this unthinkable thing. He has this Catholic commit suicide in order to find peace and salvation.
Oh, yeah.
It's absurd on one level.
Right.
But on the other hand, it's a fictional way of exposing the tension of what was going on in Catholicism.
Sure. Yeah. So we see these aren't, again, not just books for entertainment or for plot twists and surprise, but these elements within the book are meant to be the occasion for wrestling with theological themes in a way that would otherwise be somewhat inaccessible. Not totally inaccessible, but when you address things through fiction in this way, your brain can get a different handle on the issue, and you're forced to address themes and things in a from a different vantage point, a different perspective, whereas pure, you know, scholastic attempts to address some of the issues, they're just not going to get to them from the same vantage point. They're not going to access things on that level.
One of the most fascinating ways to read Green is to look at the doctrine of original sin in children, innocence and sin, in that he has some of the most brutal passages. One's it's sort of like when you read Updike and the baby drowns in Rabbit Run, you have to put the book down. Or like you mentioned Cormac, when you're reading The Road,
right,
and you have to put the book down. Almost every one of these Catholic novels, he's dealing with children. And he's dealing with children, and he's saying they're born in sin. And that the grace of God is needed to save them. And that's what makes the power and the glory, for instance, so unbelievable, is the scenes with the children. His illegitimate daughter, Green writes, so the whiskey priest's illegitimate daughter, Green says, has a stain on her heart like a spoiled spot on a piece of fruit. And it's just so striking in that he is not going to be like the secularists who say all the children are saved. Mm-hmm. And he's going to put all the realities of sin and corruption, death and salvation in regard to these children. And it makes such gripping fiction. I believe that's the key to understanding the change in Green. So, I think his best non-Catholic novel is The Quiet American, which was it's an unbelievable book because it foretold Vietnam. And it's held up today politically as one of the classics of the 20th century for that But that's where he really starts to make a transition, where he starts to think of innocence in children, not in theological terms in regard to the church being the only hope of saving, but he starts to think in terms of innocence in the political aspects of what it means in this world. And so it's not to say it isn't a Quiet American isn't a great book, but he pivots a little bit. But when we're believers and we're reading this literature and we're seeing how we're being carried along with the plot and the story, but he's adding, this is what's happening with original sin. It's so powerful. And so this is why preachers absolutely need to read literature like this. And he will be able to communicate the structure, to use the language, to be able to see how this great artist has done this. And so that's where really the secondary reason I started reading Green is my mentor, Charlie Dennison, said, you got to become a better preacher. You better start reading great literature. And this was 10 years before T. David Gordon, you know, wrote his great book on why Johnny can't preach, in that, you know, we've lost a sense of not only handling the narrative of the Bible, but also then putting it together in a way that can communicate these great themes, but also doing it in a way that this proclamation has an impact upon people, in which how you put it before them.
Yeah. What were some of the writers and works that Charlie recommended to you right away? When he said that, write, you know, read good works, great works of literature, he wasn't just telling you to go find them yourself, was he? He had some ideas.
Oh, no. Well, we basically, the classics, the canon. He was an English major at Geneva College. So that was his major. So from Faulkner and, Green and Flannery O'Connor, and Hemingway, the classics, Fitzgerald. So those were ones we always talked about. We talked about all their novels and what they were doing, and then would talk about the theology behind them. So I actually played upon that whenever we would have these talks. I played upon Steinbeck's novel Travels with Charlie. Also liked Steinbeck, so that's how I labeled all my
well, in this case Charlie was a dog, right?
Yeah, I know. When Charlie found out I was doing that, he laughed and laughed and laughed, because he understood too that I was the multiple things that were going on there.
Oh, my wife loves that book. Oh, Steinbeck, if I could write like Steinbeck. I just keep cutting more and more out. That's tremendous. So what have you speak to me a bit about some of these, you know, authors like Graham Greene. You mentioned Evelyn Waugh. You mentioned Flannery O'Connor. We've talked about Cormac McCarthy. Cormac McCarthy, not a Catholic. How would you kind of group these together, at least compare and contrast them? Maybe doing so would provide a bit of assistance to people who might not only want to read some books by Graham Greene, but look at other not works that are necessarily similar in style or theological viewpoint, but similar in the sense of the effect that they might have upon you and the value that they present for theological reflection.
Yeah. Brideshead Revisited, not only the book, but this is one of the rare places where the miniseries that was done in the early 80s is fantastic in regard to there's this thread of grace that's running through this narrative. The Hound of Heaven is pursuing this family. And Wall is so great at the events of everyday life. That's an unbelievable book. In regard to others, Flannery O'Connor's Wise Blood, spectacular. And that's actually also one of the few books that has a great movie. So the 1979 movie is I give it the biggest thumbs up on it. And that's another one where what's interesting, both O'Connor and Green in their fiction were believed that they were not interested in morality. They were interested in belief. And so they were coming at it and writing the fiction with that trumping the morality. And so there, it's incredible to read. And so that Wise Blood and then Violent Barred Away, it's a fantastic book. The same type of aspect in that belief trumps morality in this fiction. And so this is why I think that both Green and O'Connor, as much as they were different, didn't want to be labeled as Catholic writers. They saw themselves as writers, but they did have this transcendent theme,
of course,
of belief and of the super, of the God acting that really impacted them, and it makes them quite powerful. Though it's interesting is that Green frustrated O'Connor. She, you know, maybe it's the fact that I thought about this a little bit in that she made her Protestants be the one that were morally degenerate. He made the Catholics morally degenerate. But she thought, I think she thought he was being a smart aleck Jansenist in the way he was doing things in his literature.
And was she categorizing the Protestants as such because of the cheap grace and the antinomian charges that many of the, you know, of an older Catholic would, a Vatican I Catholic would place upon a Protestant? You can be justified by grace through faith. Live however you want.
I know. I think it's more with her. So she's the opposite of Green. So every day of her adult life, she read 2 hours of Thomas Aquinas in the morning. I mean, she was just disciplined, orthodox Catholic who believed with her whole heart. In some respects, you might think that she might have been mocking the Protestants for that. I don't think it is. I think it's more her sense of place comes through in where she was living in Georgia, that sense of place. Being in a Christ-haunted region, as Ralph Wood puts it for Flannery O'Connor, that's what she's bringing through more than mocking them, is that sense of place. And Green brings a sense of place in his own way. It's either England or it's Africa or it's Mexico, and he's brilliant. Both of them are absolutely stunningly brilliant in a sense of place.
Mm-hmm. That's tremendous. So where would you go, you know, with a recommendation? If you're going to provide, if someone hasn't read any of these, and where would you say, what would be the first three that you'd pick up? They don't necessarily have to be the best three, but in terms of what would be a good place to start?
Wow. Oh, man.
It's hard to pick.
I think for Graham Greene, I would probably read The Power and the Glory first, and probably read the Heart of the Matter second. While I read Brideshead Revisited, Updike, I would read The Beauty of the Lilies is probably what I would read.
Yeah.
I would read The Road.
My favorite.
Yeah. I think you have to. I mean, it's so what's interesting is that there's a strong case to be made in Green's Catholic novels that he was writing these against the backdrop of heaven and hell and of grace and judgment. There's a very strong case that he's, in other words, there's an eschatological underpinning to everything he's doing. Cormac, I think, is brilliant in that I think he removes that eschatological underpinning and shows you the horror of a world without this eschatological hope. And so it's almost as if these novels could be juxtaposed against one another so that in No Country for Old Men, it's a flip of the coin all the time what happens, right. Whereas in Green's novels it's the Hound of Heaven through the church and these the sacraments that is going to make the difference. So it's an incredible I think literary juxtaposition there. Someone should do a PhD or thesis on that.
Oh my. I read a PhD thesis on Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, which is kind of inconclusive, but if anyone has some theories on the ending to that, and especially, you know, there's a lot of borrowing from Melville and Moby Dick in there because the villain is kind of the white whale, but there's also these odd, I think, Zoroastrian themes kind of in the book, but that if you're going to see just a godless universe. I mean, that and just the depravity of humanity unrestrained, not just total depravity, but if you want to see something bordering on utter depravity, Blood Meridian is that. But The Road, also dealing with those themes, you know, it's a father-son story set in an apocalyptic world. And if you didn't like the movie, I particularly didn't think the movie was that bad, but, you know, I love the book. But a lot of people don't like the film. But if you didn't like the film, still read the book. The book is tremendous. It's a father-son story, but he's just offering hope and protection to his son after his wife abandoned them or basically killed herself in the woods because she couldn't. We're dealing with this pandemic now, right? So you imagine living in a much worse version of that for several years, what that might do to somebody. And they're just traveling toward the coast, you know, with a shopping cart, you know, trying to get to the coast. And he keeps telling his son to look to the light inside him and things are going to be better when they finally reach the coast. And the son is, you know, I don't know how old he is, 8, 9 in the setting. And he's going along with it because it's his dad and you believe your dad and, you know, your dad's telling you to do this and he's striving. And the father has nothing to live for except for his son. And what you know and what's so heartbreaking about it is his father doesn't know anything. His father has no secret info about something being better at the coast. He just needs something to live for. But within this worldview that McCarthy's constructed, it's not an eschatology of a belief in a true supernatural or in anything existential. It's just made up. and he's just striving and trying to construct his own hope and pass that on to his son so that they don't die in utter despair. It's kind of existentialist in the sense like the only rational alternative, if this is the way the universe really is, the only rational alternative is suicide. Just stop it rather than persist through this godless, you know, pointless existence.
Yeah, you know, just your description of that, which is so helpful, is takes me back to Charlie also wanted me to read Camus, wanted The Stranger, The Plague, right. The Fall, and just how powerful they are from a true literary genius philosopher who was also an atheist and had this closed system of the absurdity of what we're going through in this life, and very reminiscent of that. And so it's interesting in this literature, you know, I think we're kind of drawn as Reformed believers to those who have bringing in the elements of faith like Green and O'Connor, and those who like McCarthy and Camus, on the other hand, who are showing the very consistent in their approach. And what this in philosophically, and yet having a really a way of moving forward the pages in a satisfying, really deep way. It's I find that fascinating that we would be drawn to those type of authors.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is really where it's at. The rubber hits the road, and that's what I want when I'm reading a book, a book of fiction, a book of literature, is to be affected. It's the same thing with a film. I want to be affected. And okay, once in a while you watch something for escapism, you just want to be entertained, you want to laugh, you know, watch Bill Murray. That's fine. You know, but Bill Murray is also an artist and is in films that will affect you too. But, you know, with a book of literature, with these books we've listed, they're books that you can't trifle with. You shouldn't. You know, you really read them. You need to think. But at the same time, they're not textbooks and they're not dry or boring. They are entertaining and enjoyable, but of a much more sophisticated in a way and with such great depth. So reading literature is important, and it's good for your mind. It's good for your mind.
If just a little, if I had time here for just one sidetrack here, it's interesting to think about in regard to these novels we're talking about. A lot of them were put into to film form. And it's fascinating to me on what works in film coming off a novel and what doesn't. Green had almost every one of his books made into a film. And there's only, maybe one or two that I think hold up. And sometimes there's restrictions. Like when John Ford made The Fugitive in the late 40s, he had the prohibition. He couldn't really, which is based upon The Power and the Glory. Henry Fonda as the whiskey priest, based upon The Power and the Glory. And he really can't show on film what the book is doing. But what happens is that, to me, why can Green write the screenplay of one of the greatest movies of the 20th century, The Third Man, and it holds up so well, and I think it's on the top 10 list of almost every serious critic, and in its portrayal of Henry Lyme, the Orson Welles character. And yet his Catholic novels don't hold up well. Or why No Country for Old Men, the Coen Brothers film, can be so fantastic. We won't give in to Billy Bob Thornton's All the Pretty Horses. But in regard to that, The Third Man is about friendship. It's about friendship and what that means and what you will do for friendship. Whereas all these Catholic novels, there is this element of faith, that which is unseen, God working in invisible ways. And what happens when you try to transfer that to the screen, it doesn't come off because the screen is a visual medium. Whereas when you're reading, there's something that's left to the imagination in regard to things. So I think there's something to be said in which it's very rare that you get a movie that can do this, whether Horton Foote's Tender Mercies with Robert Duvall or something. It's really rare that you can get a movie that can talk, be a Christian in that sense that these great novels are.
And there's also a way in which a narrator, whether it's first-person narrator, or the books I've read of Green are third-person narrator, but they're not in the omniscient sense. The narrator's not telling you everything. Maybe the narrator doesn't know, but it works. But you can also in novel explore states of mind that in film you have to express them either through dialogue or through a voiceover in which the author, the character is speaking to you somehow. There have to be other devices. And depending on how the novel was worked, the screenwriter may or may not be able to convey the full weight or depth of meaning. And so when a book is translated to a movie and it's done poorly, often it's just the artifice or the shell of it that gets transferred, and the real depth of it sometimes gets missed. You get the setting, you get the look of the characters, you get the actions they perform, but it's almost hollowed out if it's not done well. And it's a great challenge. I mean, you're changing art forms. You really are. And so that's why it's so hard for it to be good in both.
A great example from Green in that is The End of the Affair. So he has a non-believing narrator. Bendrix doesn't believe. And in the book, Sarah is the one that's converted. And she, in one of the great lines Green ever writes is that she caught the faith like she caught a disease, and that's what she says in the book. But what happens is through her conversion to Christ, to Christianity, these other characters are affected after her death, and so this unbelieving narrator by the end of the book comes to believe there is a God. He didn't believe there was before, but he hates God because God took away this person he loved, Sarah, because she became this Christian. Well, that became in 1999, that was a major release as a movie with Julianne Moore playing Sarah part and Ralph Fiennes playing the Bendrix part. Is a Neil Jordan film. How do you communicate that this is what the book is about? So they recreated the Blitz during London. It's beautiful. It's spectacular. Julianne Moore looks great. The costumes, yeah, it's like as if they resurrected Edith Head. It's fantastic in regard to the look of the movie, but the book is about God working in the people after she becomes a Christian, working in the people that she meets. And so this, he's going back and read from her diary, and he's talking to these people, and he's finding out that she has impacted their life by her witness to Christ. In the movie, it's just about the loss of the love between him, between Bendrix and Sarah. And there's not that sense point of the book where the Lord has been working in the life.
Yeah, yeah. That's a great example where the rubber hits the road. You see something else is translated. And now, whether the screenwriter knew that or not, I am making no judgment. I have not seen the book or seen the movie or read the book. But often when things get translated and transitioned from one form to the other, that's exactly what might happen. Something else is emphasized entirely differently. Unless you have somebody who understands those things deeply and has a mastery of kind of both forms and can transition one to the other, it's very difficult to do. Which is why something like No Country for Old Men, which is taken from a Cormac McCarthy novel, and I don't know who did the treatment for that. I don't know if McCarthy did himself. He has written a screenplay before, but I think his first one was something recent, which actually was not
good. I'm going to say Joel and Ethan Coen.
They might have done it themselves, and they're masters. Yeah. And that it does transition very well to the screen. Before we go, I would want to recommend another work by Cormac McCarthy on the nature of faith and kind of apologetics. He wrote an actual play called The Sunset Limited, which is the name of a train. And you have one guy saving another guy from getting hit by a train. And it's a two-person, single-set play that was filmed and produced by HBO years ago. I saw it on YouTube at one point. I don't know if it's still there. But it's Tommy Lee Jones and Samuel L. Jackson. And they're just debating the existence of God and the nature of faith. It's tremendous. And excellent actors and excellent writing. I think it's a wonderful piece of work. So if you can find that, you can find the play itself and read that. The Sunset Limited, Cormac McCarthy. You can also watch the thing. And it's done very well. And since it's a play, it's acted out. So it's intended for that art form, so you don't find that mismatch necessarily. You just find an interpretation and a characterization of it on stage, and it's done really, really well. I don't know. I'd love to see that in person. I don't know if that's ever been produced. I'm sure it has somewhere. So maybe when life comes back to normal, I'll go find a place that's putting on the Sunset Limited and talk about it. It's been good. Thanks for coming by, Danny. We really appreciate you taking the time to talk about these things. Can we attempt to have this conversation? We'll try to do the power and the glory. I don't think we need to covenant with one another and grab each other's thighs or something biblically too.
I'd love that. I'd love to talk about the power and the glory.
Well, let's try that. I'll finish it up, and if there's interest, I'm sure there will be. But people can practice or not practice. They can work on reading the book and thinking through the issues, and maybe at a future episode we'll dive down and compare and contrast and work on the issues of Vatican II Catholicism in comparison to the themes and structures of Graham Greene's novel The Power and the Glory. So hopefully that'll come up soon, maybe in a month or so, but we'll get there. But it's been good. Thanks so much, Danny. I'm sure you've been hard at work with issues of New Horizons and other things. Of course, the OPC has announced that we postpone the 2020 General Assembly. But is everything with Christian Ed and other things in the office going to be okay for the time being? Are we going to get by?
Yes, I mean, I look out at the world that does not have God and does not have hope, and I don't know how they're getting through this, and just so thankful for the grace of God, and knowing you know, Christ is reigning above, and and it's also really I'm really thankful to be a part of a church that we've talked a lot about Catholicism today, that puts its hope in the risen Christ, and not infallible individuals or institutions. So,
right. Amen. Yeah. Set your minds on the things above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God, the Father in glory. You know, that's where we belong. If we're united to him, that's what we ought to think about and contemplate and look for his return. So praise be to God for that. You can find out information about what the OPC is up to and the Committee on Christian Education at opc.org. Danny is also hard at work with the Committee for the Historian. They have many publications and a lot of things are available you can find at the OPC website. And of course, grab a copy of Gerhardus Voss, the wonderful biography that Danny wrote. It's available at Reformed Forum, along with other places, Amazon, Westminster Bookstore, Reformation Heritage Books, and some places in around the world. The Reformers Bookshop down in Australia, New Zealand. So if you want to get a copy, you can do so there as well. If you got any questions, you can head on over to the website and click on the contact links and get in touch with us, and we'll try to get back to you as soon as possible. But I do want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.